Welcome to Cases from the Community, a special audio program on management of non-small cell lung cancer developed from a satellite CME symposium held at the 2018 ASCO Annual Meeting. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. The core of this program are Zoom video calls I conducted with four community-based general medical oncologists in advance of the live meeting we held in Chicago. During these Zoom calls, the oncologists presented challenging cases of patients with non-small cell lung cancer from their practices and specific questions for the faculty at the live meeting to address, which included Drs. Matthew Hellman, Corey Langer, Jeffrey Oxnard, Martin Rick, and Alice Shaw. The first case presented was an 85-year-old woman with locally advanced adenocarcinoma of the lung and a small asymptomatic brain metastasis and an isolated lytic lesion in the pelvis. The patient had no targetable genomic alterations, a PD-L1 tumor proportion score of 85%, and a good performance status. The issue was whether this patient should be considered to have oligometastatic disease and treated with curative intent, or whether she should be treated as a patient with stage 4 disease. Dr. Oxnard began the discussion.
Look, the cases don't always fit in the categories, right? This patient, yeah, we call stage 4, but some might call an extensive stage 3, and you want to give them the best shot. We've had this struggle all the time in clinic, no question. We have definitely given chemoradiation to a stage 3B plus a MET. You know, stage 3B plus two METs, a little more risky. But here's a patient where I would way rather choose today a targeted therapy approach. It's like the targeted therapies have made this decision easier because our stage 4 options are so compelling. Some of our patients with Pembro alone will have a ridiculous response which can last years. And so I agree that I'm reaching for the easy targeted therapy over the toxic and challenging chemo-rads approach in a patient like this, but it is a coin flip, and I don't know there's a right answer. You personalize it.
Corey, any other thoughts?
Before the era of PD-L1, I would have probably adopted the same approach that Maria was using, but I will reserve that should she have progression or not do that well with Pembro. I agree with Jeff. I would go with single agent Pembro in her case.
And you know, Alice, bone is not really considered kind of an oligometastatic site as opposed to, say, adrenal or brain.
Right. I mean, in general, we definitely have a long experience treating oligometastatic disease when that solitary site involves the brain or the adrenal. We know we have long-term cures in some of those patients, but once you start to involve the bone, it seems like the bone is not such a good predictor of having a single site of disease, and so we often shy away from treating those patients so aggressively.
Our first module focused on the management of patients with EGFR tumor mutations, and to begin, I asked Dr. Reck about his approach to genomic testing for an asymptomatic, clinically stable patient with metastatic adenocarcinoma of the lung.
So I would like to see the results for EGF, ALK, and ROS1, as well as the information for the NGS. And this is due to the fact that besides EGF receptor mutation and ALK and ROS1 translocations, we have new opportunities. We have something like the BRAF mutation, where we have targeted opportunities available. And furthermore, NGS may give us an opportunity also to assess tumor mutational burden very early. So I would like to have this information available as early as possible.
Matt, question from the audience. What molecular testing do you recommend for patients for stage 1, 2, and 3A disease in the community?
For my own practice, we do usually do next-generation sequencing on those tumors, realizing that, unfortunately, the vast majority of those patients, even with early-stage disease, will relapse, and that it's useful to have that information in hand. At the same time, I'm not routinely using that information to inform adjuvant therapy, and so I could understand people not doing it unless they needed it for metastatic disease.
Corey?
So, again, off-study, there's no indication, but there is the Alchemist trial, the ongoing prospective randomized phase 3 with two EGFR and ALK component that's looking at TKIs, and of course the much larger component that does not have either oncogenic driver. That study was amended a year and a half ago to look at NEVO versus observation. So it's being run through Foundation so you can get the testing done under the aegis of a clinical trial.
The next case was a 66-year-old woman presenting with a primary adenocarcinoma of the lung with three small brain metastases. The patient was found to harbor an exon 21 EGFR tumor mutation and initially had moderate weakness in the left hand that quickly and completely resolved with corticosteroids. And the question in this case was twofold. First, is osimertinib in general now the optimal initial treatment for metastatic disease in activating EGFR tumor mutations? And second, in a patient such as this one, presenting with minimal but definite symptoms from brain metastases, is it generally preferable to initiate stereotactic radiation or to start a highly active agent in the CNS, specifically osimertinib? I asked Dr. Hellman for his opinion.
For my own practice, I've been giving osimertinib as the first-line therapy for patients with newly diagnosed EGFR mutant lung cancers like this. I think for someone that had now asymptomatic brain metastasis, I would probably have just started with osimertinib and maybe check an MRI in a short interval, whether that's 2 or 3 weeks, to make sure that there is a response. I think the particular case with a lesion in the pons, like maybe there might be some critical structures like the brainstem that I might be interested in semi-prophylactically radiating just for fear of like that growing in the future. But in general, I think at the upfront management, I would feel comfortable starting osimertinib in a patient who's asymptomatic.
Corey, is your first line therapy, will you agree with the audience, osimertinib, and what about this situation?
Definitely agree with the audience. I think OC is in this patient's immediate future. Low threshold, though, to initiate SRS. The patient's not asymptomatic, it's on steroids, and you want to wean that patient off steroids. So if OC doesn't accomplish that quickly, I would step in with SRS.
Martin, osimertinib at this point?
Nope. I would start with stereotactic radiotherapy. So you have a good chance to control this with a minimum of stereotactic radiotherapy, and afterwards you can start with osimertinib.
But is osimertinib your first-line TKI?
I think so. I'm coming from Europe, so we have also some use of afatinib in this situation, but I think osimertinib has the better data so far.
The next case was a 50-year-old woman with metastatic adenocarcinoma of the lung and an EGFR L858R mutation. The patient responded to erlotinib but experienced severe dermatologic toxicity, and the question was the option to switch the patient to osimertinib, which was recently approved in the first-line setting for patients with EGFR exon 19 and 21 mutated metastatic non-small cell lung cancer based on the landmark FLAURA trial. Dr. Shaw responded.
I absolutely would switch them. I have switched them for this exact reason, where they have dermatologic issues that even after, you know, we've tried dose reduction and other conservative measures, really does not respond. I have no problem switching them to osimertinib. Osimertinib, as everyone knows, is now approved for the first-line use in patients with EGFR mutation. And even without we wouldn't expect this patient to have T790M mutation. She has not become resistant to the first-generation drug, and she does not need the T790M to start on osimertinib.
Jeff, I don't know whether you see cases like this, but any thoughts about the patient who's struggling on erlotinib or the first generation agents?
I've definitely switched them. I mean, I've switched patients from afatinib to erlotinib. We do this, right? These drugs are relatively similar. They're not going to tolerate osimertinib magically. I mean, it has some side effects, so they may also have some side effects, but it would be better tolerated. What we want to do is keep the drug on, not have interruptions. Interruptions breed resistance. Keep the drug going and don't have any interruptions to therapy. Osi's more likely to give you that.
We've also heard questions, Jeff, from oncologists in practice about patients who are responding but don't have any symptoms.
Would you switch a patient like that? Only if there's toxicity or there's resistance.
So with those, you keep the old algorithm, T790 testing at relapse, old being 2 years ago, incidentally, but you would continue down that algorithm.
Yeah, it could last them a long time. Don't want to burn through a bridge. It is true, T790M testing is only a relevant question at resistance. If they have resistance and they don't have T790M, osimertinib is not the drug for them. But up until then, it's okay to try switching.
Quick question from the audience, Jeff. What is the agent of choice for leptomeningeal disease with exon 19 mutation?
I think Osi is the best, most potent drug for the brain, and including for leptomeningeal disease. I'm not sure you need 160. I will often start with 80 instead of struggling with insurance to get 160 reimbursed. But if 80 is not working, I will try 160 to optimize the chance of effect.
In the second module, we focused on the recent advances in the management of patients with ALK, ROS1, RET, and BRAF genomic alterations. And to begin, Dr. Shaw commented on the management of patients with RET alterations.
So briefly, you know, RET fusions are a known oncogenic driver in about 1-2% of our non-small cell lung cancer patients. And up until recently, we were a little bit limited because we only had these older multi-targeted RET inhibitors like vandetanib and cabozantinib, some that you guys know. These are approved for other cancer types. And those drugs had some limited activity, but were really, the problem was toxicity. But fortunately, just in the last several months, we've now heard data about some very potent and selective RET inhibitors, and we're seeing really, really impressive responses, just like we would see with an ALK TKI for ALK or an EGFR TKI for EGFR patients, and much less toxicity. So we're really excited about these RET TKIs, and really just highlights the importance of also doing that multiplex screening, not just for EGFR, ALK, and ROS, but also for these other drivers like RET.
And Jeff, we found that the investigators are going first line with BRAF, ALK, ROS1, EGFR. At that point, not RET. Are we ready to start using targeted therapy first line with RET, Jeff?
The data is impressive. It's coming. It's definitely coming. These are first line drugs.
And is this going to be used in thyroid also?
Yep, big thyroid activity as well. Thyroid and lung both.
Awesome. Corey, you had a comment?
No, just that I think we're seeing a shift as these new agents come out that are much more specific and more active. We'll increasingly be using TKIs up front.
The next case was a 62-year-old woman with metastatic adenocarcinoma of the lung and an ALK tumor translocation who was initially started on crizotinib, which was discontinued due to very bothersome visual changes and fatigue. The patient was then started on alectinib and responded and tolerated it well, but developed progressive disease 8 months later. She is currently on brigatinib and faring well. The question in this case was how to identify patients who would benefit from brigatinib and what side effects patients on this drug may experience. I asked Dr. Shaw to comment on tolerability of brigatinib, which was recently approved in patients with disease progression on crizotinib, and the ALTA trial, which led to the approval of this agent.
So the ALTA trial was a randomized phase 2 trial of brigatinib in patients, ALK-positive patients, who had failed crizotinib, okay, not alectinib, just crizotinib, and they looked at two separate doses of brigatinib. Brigatinib is very, very active in patients who have failed crizotinib, high response rate in the 45 to 55% range, and also very good intracranial activity, higher with the standard dose. The standard dose is 90 milligrams for 1 week and then up to 180 milligrams. So very active drug, but again, just to point out, this drug is approved for the crizotinib-resistant setting, and we actually have essentially no data on brigatinib in the post-alectinib setting, which is what this patient was in. The way we use it in practice is primarily for patients who have failed crizotinib.
Could I just ask what you would do in a situation where a patient's refusing chemo and, you know, relatively stable?
Well, the drug where we have a lot of experience post-alectinib is actually lorlatinib, which is a third-generation drug, and that drug is good to know about because it's going to be approved in the next few months. And our hope is, based on the data at hand, is that it'll be approved for patients who have failed one or more TKIs, and that will include alectinib.
And again, any anecdotal experience with brigatinib after alectinib?
There is anecdotal experience. We actually have a series that we already submitted for publication looking at activity of brigatinib specifically in post-alectinib patients, and there is some activity. The response rate was about 17%, but the median progression-free survival is rather short at about 4 months. And again, just in terms of who are those patients, those 17% who are responding, they tend to be the patients where we can identify an ALK resistance mutation after alectinib, usually in the tumor, but even sometimes in blood as well. That seems to be a way to predict for those patients who could respond to brigatinib.
What about her question about toxicity with brigatinib?
So it's a really important question because brigatinib, among all of the ALK inhibitors, has this very unique toxicity that everyone needs to know about. And it is called early pulmonary toxicity, where after a single dose of brigatinib, a small percentage, probably 5% or less of patients, can develop significant respiratory symptoms. It's kind of like a very rapid onset pneumonitis. And so, in fact, that is why the standard dosing is to start at half the dose, 90 milligrams, for 1 week, make sure they do okay, and then if they're fine, then move them up to 180. I'm seeing in practice, many patients are just starting at 180, and I'm seeing a lot of respiratory symptoms right off the bat.
That's interesting, because Dr. Rodriguez was mentioning that she went through that initial period, now she's in the second dose. Now, if you get to the second dose,
you're fine.
Fine.
Yeah, you have the normal low-level risk of pneumonitis that we see with all TKIs, but not this unique early pulmonary toxicity.
Corey, you had a comment?
I have, like Alice, a fair amount of experience with this agent. And if you get through that first week, it's one of the best-tolerated TKIs that target ALK. The pulmonary toxicity will generally occur in that first week. And some of these patients can be rechallenged, albeit with a lot of trepidation.
And if they do have the pulmonary problem, you just stop the drug, you give corticosteroids? What
yes.
do you do?
You can stop the drug, you can treat with steroids. Oftentimes, they will get through it, meaning they'll improve and you can rechallenge them. It's just that the problem is there's a very small percentage of patients who can have very severe respiratory symptoms and it can even be fatal. So we do take it very seriously.
But otherwise, from a quality of life point of view, Corey?
Good.
Quite. I actually don't find it that easy. I find it kind of in between crizotinib and alectinib, but overall, it's pretty well tolerated.
People have different tolerance for toxicity, but the issue with fatigue that she complained about with crizotinib, have you seen that profound fatigue?
Yes. In the old days when we only had crizotinib, it was interesting. Everyone tolerated it great. Now we've got these great TKIs. People have really high expectations. And so really the fatigue from crizotinib varies from very mild to more severe. And so that's not out of a range of what we might see.
She was also telling me that the patient really did not like the visual changes. What do patients describe to you? And do you see this with any other TKIs?
No, the visual disturbance is really unique for crizotinib. And you know, it's pretty mild usually. I mean, most patients aren't bothered. It usually really is just triggered by a change in lighting, so from dark to bright light, and then it's transient and goes away. So I'm a little surprised that she was so bothered by it.
So let's walk through a little bit kind of where the audience is in terms of ALK metastatic disease. So we tried to make it a little tricky by putting in a high TPS score, which I hear you see with ALK patients, incidentally. Maybe, yeah, Martin, you can comment on that. But everybody, regardless of that, is sticking with a TKI and alectinib for most patients. Do you agree? Do you see high PD-L1?
So we do see this frequently, that these patients, and in particular with the ALK translocation, they present with a high PD-L1 expression on the tumor cells. We are not sure about the biological importance of this PD-L1 overexpression, and I think the general principle should be if there is an treatable oncogenic alteration, I would go for targeted therapy. So I clearly would favor the targeted therapy. And so far, we have the best data for alectinib. So I would start with alectinib in that patients.
The next case was a 54-year-old woman with metastatic adenocarcinoma of the lung and a BRAF V600E tumor mutation who received multiple therapies, including a checkpoint inhibitor, and finally received dabrafenib-trametinib, which resulted in a dramatic objective response that continues 2 years later. However, the patient's course has been complicated with recurrent febrile episodes requiring corticosteroids and dose reduction. I asked Dr. Oxnard if this is a common clinical course.
Yeah, definitely. If you treat melanoma, you know this, right? And it is manageable. It's just weird. You just got to be ready for it. You dose interrupt. You see if they get better. You try it again. You generally can re-challenge them and get them to a dose they can tolerate. Sometimes you don't need to dose adjust. First time, I just retreat. Second time, I might dose adjust to find a better dose. Yeah. But you just got to be prepared for it because it is the weird toxicity of this regimen.
What about this issue of line of therapy, Cora? We saw a lot of investigators in our survey going for first-line therapy. The audience, most of them will use anti-BRAF, this combination first-line. What about you?
As would I. This BRAF V600 specifically has, in my opinion, moved to first-line along with ROS, ALK, and EGFR. The median PFS in that group with this combination is in the 9 to 10-month range. This particular patient's done twice as well as one might have predicted.
So another question we wanted to get into, and it leads into another case that we heard about, Alice, is a young patient of Dr. Loban's, a non-smoker presented with bulky, locally advanced disease. Now, Dr. Loban's, actually, his case was ROS1, but we put this question out to the audience, which was, if you know the patient has an ALK rearrangement, would you use targeted therapy to shrink the tumor down prior to chemo radiation? There was a big trial that was attempting to look at that. I believe that it's no longer moving forward, but it seemed like kind of made a lot of sense intuitively. Alice, what do you think about that concept of using targeted therapy prior to chemo radiation?
Well, I certainly like it. We know how responsive these tumors will be to an ALK inhibitor, and often these tumors are, if they're presenting as a bulky 3B, it's going to be really hard to safely administer them definitive chemo radiation. So I really like this idea. I have even done it in a patient before, but there is really not data to support doing it. And so it's kind of one of those things where you talk with each patient about sort of the pros and cons of this type of approach and then go forward. But I do like the approach of trying induction ALK TKI then followed by your chemo radiation.
There's data in EGFR, right? The ASCENT trial, actually at ASCO this year, doing this with EGFR, and the proof of principle really was quite successful. You just got to be careful and watch closely. I don't always do it unless it's really bulky and I want them to have a better chemo radiation course. If it's not too big, just do the chemo radiation.
And would you, for example, do it with a ROS1? Would you do a crizotinib, for example, Jeff?
If you're having a hard time planning curative therapy and you think a TKI can help, it's okay to use. But if you can plan curative therapy without the TKI, give the curative therapy.
The next module focused on one of the most exciting recent developments in lung cancer management, the historic PACIFIC trial that evaluated the use of 1 year of therapy with the anti-PD-L1 antibody durvalumab as consolidation treatment in patients receiving chemoradiation therapy of locally advanced non-small cell lung cancer. The case we discussed was a 67-year-old woman with stage 3B adenocarcinoma of the lung who is currently receiving chemoradiation therapy, and the question was whether this is now generally standard of care and whether to recommend durvalumab to this particular patient with severe chronic COPD requiring oxygen.
We asked the audience, do you think that durvalumab in general is standard of care? They almost all say yes. Corey, agree?
Yes.
I know. I remember talking to you when I think the durvalumab press release was out, or the Pacific press release was out, but we hadn't seen the data, and you were like very kind of skeptical, it's only PFS. And then when you saw the data, you were like, oh, yeah, well, we're going to use it.
I was still skeptical because the OS data hadn't come out.
Right.
But now it's been announced as positive. I am no longer skeptical. There is no other agent in the setting that's led to an OS advantage.
So, Matt, what about chemoradiation therapy, locally advanced disease with durvalumab, and people with EGFR and ALK and targetable mutations? Yet half of the audience is saying they would not use durvalumab in these patients. What do you think, Matt?
I don't see any reason to limit it. I think that the degree of benefit towards a curative opportunity has been really profound. And realizing that the fraction of people who have EGFR altered disease, I think the fraction that will truly benefit from durvalumab is probably small. But I think the risks are also small. And if they are that small fraction of people that are cured as a result of it, this is tremendous, and nobody's been cured with a TKI so far. So I think for me, given the data, given the sort of enrollment across all these molecular markers, and the fact that there was sort of a trend towards improvement in the EGFR mutant population, makes me want to do it.
So as Corey was saying, now we're layering on another therapy on top of a therapy that we know is going to cause problems over, you know, the next 6 months or even longer. So we said, Corey, what about the patient who's having esophagitis? Obviously very common with chemoradiation. Interestingly, a quarter of the audience would not give durvalumab in a patient having esophagitis. Corey, agree or disagree?
Esophagitis is generally time-limited, occurs toward the end of chemoradiation, may peak a bit afterwards, but then die down, and I'm not aware of this agent particularly exacerbating esophagitis, so I would plunge ahead.
The next question is another issue, which is the patient who has had chemoradiation therapy and on imaging has radiation changes. Okay, so asymptomatic, and the audience is really split about what to do. My understanding is that almost everybody who gets chemo radiation will have changes radiologically. So theoretically, I guess the people in the trial had it. Would that, if the patient was asymptomatic, would had radiologic changes compatible with radiation, Corey, would that get you to not use durvalumab?
No, I'd still use it. In the absence of symptoms, it's symptomatic pneumonitis that I think would deter me.
Depends on the extent of the pneumonitis. If you only have local reaction, I think I would completely agree. If you have a vast reaction, I would be careful.
So Alice, Dr. Picton, first of all, she believes, based on her clinical experience, that patients with COPD are more likely to have pneumonitis related to checkpoint inhibitors. I'm going to ask you whether you think that's true or not. But she has this patient, 67-year-old woman, wants to be treated, who has stage 3B disease, but she has not only COPD, but she's on oxygen. So, Alice, durvalumab or not?
I would say yes. I don't exclude patients based on having COPD. And I can't say in my practice that I feel like those with COPD have a higher risk of that. If they have underlying interstitial lung disease, that's different. Some evidence of fibrosis, sure. But COPD on its own, no, I don't use that.
I mean, I have a higher risk of a COPD flare.
Sure.
Well, that's what I was going to say, that, you know, it's pretty hard to separate out, really, as we've been talking about, actually what's going on. Matt, you've written a lot, you've studied a lot this issue of pneumonitis with checkpoint inhibitors. How do you approach patients who are on a checkpoint inhibitor, have respiratory symptoms, in terms of trying to figure out, is it, you know, comorbidity or the actual checkpoint inhibitor?
It's really a challenge. I think it's hard to differentiate progressive cancer from infection, from pneumonitis. So we'd acknowledge the challenge. I think Martin was absolutely right that imaging is key. And it's really a CT scan. A chest x-ray, I don't think, is particularly helpful, either for seeing pneumonitis or for differentiating what's what. Oftentimes, especially in someone who's sick, someone who's hospitalized, we end up treating all of it simultaneously. And it's not particularly satisfying until they're better. And then, you know, it's not as elegant as we'd hope, but if they're better, so be it. So I'll take it. I've done that a lot, where we're treating antibiotics and steroids simultaneously. doesn't feel great, but if they get better, I'll take it.
I am kind of curious about your clinical experiences, Jeff, particularly in terms of pneumonitis. And again, you're layering in a new therapy as a patient is recovering from a pretty significant therapy. What are you seeing in your practice?
The main reason I'm not using durvalumab post-chemo rads is the patient says, I'm just not up for it today, doc. Can we check in again in a month? And then they defer again, and then they recur, right? And so I just find that patients kind of want to be done, and you need to work on them to say, look, this makes a difference. Today's the day. Let's get started. This is part of your treatment.
And what are you seeing, Jeff, in terms of how it plays out? I know it's early, but in terms of tolerability of durvalumab in this setting?
I've only had a couple. It's tolerable, okay. I haven't had any home runs yet. I've had some recurrences. We got to try it a little bit more.
Corey?
About 10 patients so far, remarkably little toxicity, but only 2 to 6 months into treatment. By and large, pretty well tolerated.
Martin was referring to timing. And somebody wants to know, what about when you're giving carbopaclitaxel? Often you give a consolidation treatment afterwards. If you're going to do that, where does the durvalumab come in?
I haven't actually done that, but I guess if you were treating with definitive chemo-RAS with weekly carbotaxel, you would probably plan to then follow with your consolidation chemo and then follow with durvalumab after you completed the chemo.
I think Pacific did not include any consolidation chemo, though, right?
Exactly.
I mean, there was a Japanese study that suggested the consolidation chemo didn't add anything to the concurrent chemo. I'm not doing as much consolidation chemo as I used to, honestly.
Okay. So before we move on, just quick question. I think I'll let Jeff handle this one. 75-year-old woman, ECOG performance status 2, 40-pack year tobacco history, cessation 5 years ago, rheumatoid arthritis on methotrexate and prednisone, non-small cell lung cancer, squamous cell cancer, no mets, PD-L1 60%, carbotaxel concurrently, methotrexate and prednisone stopped, started on durvalumab, rheumatoid arthritis symptoms worsened, restarted methotrexate, so far the patient's stable. Concerned that this patient's not going to be able to complete durvalumab toxicity. Any thoughts in general about this case, Jeff?
I share your concern. You gave it a try. I think, you know, you give them a shot now at curative therapy, right? They're cured. So why torture them, right? So let's see if they have a shot. I don't think these patients were excluded from the Pacific trial. This is off-label. You can give it a shot if you want, but if it gives them problems, then take a break, and you can always try it again if they recur. I hate to say it.
Corey?
It should be noted that only about 40 or 42% or so were actually able to complete the full year of Durva.
Right.
So this is no surprise. And I think as we start extending this into the real world in a patient population that might not have been candidates for Pacific, that'll be more likely the case. But remember, despite that, we're still seeing an OS benefit. Mm. Docetaxel, Paccarbo, anything else you can think of has not shown that. So I have made a switch. I have stopped giving consolidation Paccarbo.
Try one dose, right, Corey? You know, let's just try it, see how the first dose goes. See how the second dose goes, and suddenly you're doing it, and you're curing people.
So a couple of quick questions from the audience. Jeff, if a patient relapses within 12 months of completing consolidation durvalumab after chemo radiation, what's next?
That sounds like that means it's about 2 years since they got chemo, because they got consolidation for a year, and so I'd probably reach back for chemo before I go back to IO.
First-line chemo or second-line, Jeff?
First-line.
Okay. So
you make it up, right? Is that second-line or first-line? You call it what you want.
Well, but you'd re-challenge with platinum, right?
You'd give platinum. Yeah. Platinum. I give him real platinum doublet, yeah.
In the next module, we discuss the role of immune checkpoint inhibitors in combination with chemotherapy or anti-angiogenic agents for the treatment of metastatic disease. A case was presented of a 63-year-old woman with adenocarcinoma of the lung and brain metastases who was enrolled on the EMPOWER 150 trial and received carboplatin paclitaxel in combination with atezolizumab and bevacizumab, followed by maintenance atezolizumab and bevacizumab. Currently, the patient has no measurable disease 2 years after starting treatment, and the treating oncologist wanted to obtain the faculty's advice regarding the possibility of stopping the maintenance therapy. Dr. Hellman responded,
I don't have like a hard and fast rule about stopping at a certain time point. In my own practice, there usually something happens that's a reason to stop, whether that's toxicity, holiday, doing exceptionally well, so much so that sometimes it looks like a complete response. There's usually some reason. I have very few patients who continue on therapy beyond 2 years. There is data to say that for patients who seem to be having ongoing benefit, that there's value to at least continuing beyond 1 year. But my guess is that the vast majority of patients are receiving the vast majority of their benefit early. If for some reason we needed to stop, I don't stress that much about it.
Martin, what about this issue of stopping? And do we know anything about if you stop, can you reinduce a response with checkpoint inhibitors?
So we have little information on that. The only trial which addresses this question has been the CheckMate 153, where patients were randomized to continuation of nivolumab or stop of nivolumab with a re-exposition at time of progression after 1 year of benefit with nivolumab. And we have seen a continuous benefit for those patients who went on with nivolumab. But we also have seen the chance to get another response with the re-exposition is quite low. So there were a few stabilizations. So overall, I'm not so much convinced about this concept of re-exposition. And I haven't seen any data for this so far.
So let's run through some of the algorithmic questions that come up. And of course, even if you have an algorithm, there's always exceptions to every situation in terms of what might happen. Jeff, maybe you can react to what the audience is doing. So we say, okay, in terms of first-line therapy, non-squamous disease, TPS under 50%, we said 10%. And the audience at this point, even in this situation, is going with the triplet. Then we bump it up and say, okay, what about if the TPS is high, over 50%. And Jeff, we still have a third of the audience say, I would go with the triplet, although now obviously you see a lot more pembrolizumab. And of course, from the very beginning, when people saw these data, the first situation they thought about was the symptomatic patient. And here the audience is much more in favor of triplet therapy. Jeff, is this sort of your algorithm or no?
I like giving them a shot at single agent if they're high TPS because, you know, that's living the dream. If you can have stage 4 lung cancer on a single agent, no side effects, that's what we're trying to offer our patients. But none of these are a sure bet for anyone. The thing we don't want to do is undertreat these patients or maybe let them pseudo-progress for too long, right? We have effective therapies. Don't withhold them for your patients. If you're going to sequence them, do them carefully. But in the high TPS, I try to sequence them and start with pembro first.
Corey?
This patient is significant respiratory distress, so I feel the likelihood of one shot on goal and I will do the triplet. On the other hand, an older, frailer patient, perhaps low metastatic burden, perhaps increased comorbidity, I'll go single agent.
The next case was a 61-year-old woman with a history of rheumatoid arthritis who was found to have adenocarcinoma of the lung with an EGFR exon 20 insertion. The question about this patient for the faculty was the role of immunotherapy in patients with this alteration and how a history of rheumatoid arthritis affects the decision. Dr. Oxnard shared his thoughts.
Generally, like I think about it like this. If you get a high PD-L1 back, okay, let's remember there are some patients where that doesn't count. If they have a real genotype or they're a never smoker, I don't trust it. An IO is not likely to work. If I'm going to use an IO, I'll use it last line or I might use it with chemo where it's just adding toxicity but not doing much. Gives them a shot at it, right? And so in this person, I would tend to give him a shot at chemo, add the IO if I think they can tolerate it, not sure with the RA. And that's in general with my EGFR mutants, all right? I'm not trusting single agent immune therapy is going to work.
So, Alice, I'm a little surprised to see our impression over the years has been exon 20 actually doesn't respond to these TKIs. Is that like the wrong answer, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, that has been the case. Almost all of those atypical EGFR mutations are not responsive to these first and second generation EGFR inhibitors. And so I would not choose to use one of those, certainly not first line, second line, or probably possibly ever, because especially we have these new drugs in clinical trials that are looking promising potentially for EGFR exon 20. For a patient like this, I actually would favor a chemo IO approach in this patient. She's a never smoker. In the KEYNOTE 189 trial, the subgroup of never smokers did actually have a significant benefit to the chemo IO compared to chemo. So I don't think there's any problem treating a never smoker, even though she's got an EGFR exon 20 with the chemo IO combo.
You know, this whole story about checkpoint inhibitors and people targeting mutations just sort of popped up, at least in my head. Alicia Seek was the first one who brought it up to me. And then we started to hear investigators saying, no, we delay it till after chemo, way. And now, Corey, it kind of sounds like you're kind of starting to move back up, or no?
For those with actionable mutations, the oncogenic driver dictates treatment.
Yeah, but I'm talking about where do the IO fit in? Like, for example, let's say they go on osimertinib, you know, where does an IO fit in?
So
next, or
this patient would potentially get it second or third line, not front line. And now we do have data, not for exon 20, but for at least EGFR and ALK, because from EMPOWER 150 that included these folks and did show at least a PFS advantage for the quadruplet with Bev, Pat Carbo, and Atezo compared to the 4599 regimen.
But what I was saying is just for this patient who does not have a targetable, you know, EGFR exon 20 is not targetable. So after, you know, you could try your clinical trials. If you wanted to try IO, I would be comfortable trying it with
the chemo. Complicating feature here is the severe rheumatoid arthritis.
Yes, absolutely.
I would default to my old standard PEMCARBO-BEV.
Yeah. So real simple question, what do you do with a patient with metastatic squamous cell cancer and a low TPS score? You go to 10 different people, you're going to get 10 different therapies, it kind of looks like. But I was interested because we've said, you know, regulatory and reimbursement issues aside, Martin, what is state-of-the-art first-line therapy for metastatic squamous cell?
Yeah, good question. So we will have different opportunities. It will be a taxane-based chemotherapy with pembrolizumab or atezolizumab, but it's difficult to make any differentiation between both of these treatment opportunities.
But just to clarify, Matt, are we at triplet therapy for squamous now?
I think we will be.
All right. So another interesting fact. Just to, again, you know, in terms of the granularity of clinical practice, I'll just quickly throw this out to Martin. Another patient at Dr. Picton presents with metastatic squamous, high TPS, pretty straightforward algorithmic type of question in terms of what you do. But the thing, Martin, that was interesting that she was asking about, this patient had extensive comorbidities, but she was getting peritoneal dialysis. Martin, what do you do with somebody who's on dialysis, either peritoneal, she was saying peritoneal was given every day, or hemodialysis? Yeah. How does that change what you do?
I think I would contact the specialist, but I would go on with a regular schedule of treating the patient.
And actually, that's what she did. She responded, and she actually died of her comorbidities while in response from the checkpoint inhibitor.
The monoclonal antibodies are too big to be filtered by the kidney anyway, so it wouldn't matter. Yeah.
So, like, what happens to them, though? They get metabolized?
In the bloodstream, probably, but it's not something that's filtered through the kidney.
Okay, Alice, 52-year-old, metastatic adenocarcinoma, TPS 90%, history of liver transplant. Progressed after platinum doublet. What's next? Alice, you have a terrible situation with an incurable situation. Patients progressed after platinum, no targetable lesions. Pembro?
Well, I think as you're saying, there's not a lot of data, but I would be quite worried about their transplanted organ, to be honest. So I'd talk to my transplant colleagues, we'd talk to the patient, and we'd make a decision about it. But I would have concerns about exposing them to PD-1.
Yeah. Martin, somebody presented a case to me of someone who had a heart transplant, which was rejected, and the patient died on an IO. What do we know about transplants and IOs, Martin?
So I know the colleagues from France, they collected some cases, and they said, well, you have the 50% chance to run into severe complications after immunotherapy. And so you really have to discuss this from patient to patient with your transplant specialist and with the patient. It's a high-risk treatment in that group of patients.
Obviously, kidney transplants are a very different situation. Corey?
I've had a patient who flat-out rejected getting IO because the kidney transplant, we were forced to give docetaxel, didn't work, patient died. The kidneys, I would do. Liver and heart, no way.
In the final module, we talked about the potential role of combination therapy with anti-PD-1, PD-L1, and anti-CTLA-4 antibodies. To begin, an interesting case of a 75-year-old frail woman, a current smoker, who was diagnosed in 2014 with ER-positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer and treated successfully with hormonal therapy. In 2017, during routine surveillance, a small lesion in the lung was detected and was proven on biopsy to be a small cell lung cancer. I asked Dr. Reck how he would manage this patient.
So, first of all, I would be a little bit in doubt about the diagnosis, whether this really could be small cell lung cancer, and I would irradiate the nodule, and that would be everything I would offer to her.
What would you do if it were a young patient who was otherwise fit, Martin?
I would operate it.
Operate it, even though it was, quote, small cell. Matt, any thoughts?
Exactly the same.
So, and if it was small cell at surgery, I would then give chemo, which is standard of care after resection.
Adjuvant, then as an adjuvant treatment, yes.
And Alice, we posed the question, we asked the audience, what's their second line therapy? And actually the audience is kind of split between more chemo and ipi-nivo. Alice, what we've been hearing about is ipi-nivo in this situation. Is that what you do?
We do use it quite a lot in sort of the second line setting. I mean, based on CheckMate 032, where we did see a response rate in the 20% range or so in second and third line small cell patients. But really what we're going for is that tail, right? We want to give these patients the opportunity to get immunotherapy and potentially be long-term survivors. And I worry about pushing off the immunotherapy too late.
We asked the audience what their perception is, and maybe a lot of this is coming from melanoma, about the toxicity of this combination. Most of the audience feels that it's just more of the same, but a significant number, and I'm starting to hear this from investigators, I really didn't hear this earlier on, that not only is it more, but it's different. What's your impression?
I think there is more toxicity with adding a CTLA-4 to a PD-1. I think that there is sort of experience from melanoma that was much more. And I'm not sure that that's the case with the sort of improved dosing regimen we have in non-small cell lung cancer, where both with ipilimumab or tremelimumab, given at lower doses and less frequently, the degree of toxicity, I think, has been much more manageable.
What about the types of toxicity? I always thought that they were the same. Are there any different ones that you see with this combination that you don't see?
I think there are some differences. So with the CTLA-4, there tends to be more colitis as well as hypophysitis. CTLA-4 ligand can be expressed in the pituitary, and so there may be actually a direct binding effect in the pituitary that's specific to CTLA-4. With PD-1, there tends to be more different types of endocrinopathies, like thyroiditis in particular. So there is a different landscape of toxicities.
Corey, we asked the audience, do you think that tumor mutation burden is now here in terms of clinical practice? The audience is kind of says yes, but some say no.
I question the audience whether they're actually using it for their clinical decision making. We're on the cusp, but I think in routine practice, not quite yet. If and when we see OS data from 227, formal OS data, that may change abruptly.
Corey, case from the audience. 61-year-old man, ECOG-1, metastatic adenocarcinoma, TPS is 0, progresses after 4 cycles of carbapenem/bev. Would you add an IO to chemo or switch to single agent?
So 0 PD-L1 and progressing right off the bat.
I think or would you get a TMB?
I would do that, but I would still put this person on an IO. I mean, that would be the standard approach here.
Matt?
I think the same.
If the TMB was high, would you give ipi/nivo?
I would, yeah.
So there's an example where it may make a difference.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our community-based general medical oncologist and to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special audio version of a satellite symposium presented during the 2018 ASCO annual meeting.